Once upon a time, I was of the mind.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Cab. Yes, it's Collateral Confessions, Miami Nice's LA nighttime digression with my wonderful co-host and navigator, Katie Walsh. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
So we are driving around in this yellow cab, and the passenger we have tonight, yes, he is creepy. Yes, he is mysterious. Yes, he has had coyotes come upon him in the night. Yes, he has a body double sticker on his laptop. Yes, he is one of the most talented critical minds, one of the best writers I know, one of the most powerful and gushy podcast guests. And when he dedicates himself to anything that he is obsessed with, he's just the best. And we love him. And it's so great to have him back. You would have heard him on our most recent mashup podcast, Increment Nice. He, of course, is the host of Increment Vice. It is Travis Woods. Hello, my friend.
Creepy. What the fuck? Creepy.
I was gushing.
Like, I know you're a little hungover and you're grasping for words wherever you can find them. But and
listen,
you started at creepy and ended the arc with gushy.
Travis, creepy with love. Creepy with love. You are a man who is writing the definitive Brian De Palma book right now.
That's passion.
Yeah, passion, horniness. I'm passionate. Yes.
He was trying to say you're mysterious.
Mysterious.
I mean, I'm not, but I'll take that. I'll take that.
Mysterious, yes.
You're getting in the cab. We don't know what your intentions are.
Yeah, we don't know.
You're flashing stacks.
Sometimes.
Don't you guys miss Taxi Cab Confessions?
Yes, that's what this is. That's what this is.
I get it. I know. I'm thinking out loud. Sorry. I'm not as on point as I should be today. I'm so thrown by Blake calling me creepy.
I love you.
My fragile eggshell ego is crumbling.
You just can't see the love in my eyes because I have sunglasses on during this episode.
He does. Blake is on Gatorade number 2. It's 6 a.m. Australia time.
This man is dedicated to the podcast lifestyle.
That's the discipline, folks. In the parlance of our show and our entire community, that's the discipline. When we go out and we put our Miami Nice cap on, we must go out and consume mojitos. And then when it's time for an early morning cab ride, we're waking up, we're hitting the Gatorades, we're getting our sunglasses on, we're too early in the morning and we're going. This is what's happening.
Blake was out all night at a jazz club. Then he spent the morning sleeping on Neil McCulley's floor. Pushed himself up. Got a big swollen elbow.
When are you going to get some furniture? When I get around to it.
So
we've been having lots of conversations recently. I think some Hall of Fame chats. Miami Vice Hall of Fame chat with you, Trav. Such a fun time talking.
Like a year ago.
Yeah.
This time last year.
Was it exactly?
And I'm sober. Speaking of drinking, I'm actually sober this time.
Oh my God. Well done. Thank you. But you have also in the last episode that we did talk about, you did help Katie Walsh's nerves before the Miami Vice screening, the American Cinematheque, with a mango mojito. And you guys have held the Vice Summit. But there's always more to talk about with man. And you're always such a fun person to talk to about it. You're one of my favorites. And Katie and I couldn't wait to get you to talk back on the show to talk about it, because you're an LA person now, Missourian originally, to LA, but you have a particular I want to say like a particular sort of style or a particular affinity for affinity for the style of LA movies in all of their different sort of genres and all over time, you know, whether it's all the way back to sort of like 50s detective noir, all the way to contemporary stuff like Point Break, which Katie, you know, one of Katie's favorite movies. So we really wanted to get you in the cab here to talk about Collateral and to talk about where it fits and what your big takeaways from it are, because I know that I believe you've seen it a couple of times in the last couple of years on the big screen as well. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I am. Well, I'll start off by saying, yes, I am an L.A. aficionado. I think I'm closing in on having lived in L.A. longer than I've actually lived in the dreaded, horrible state from which I come from. I've been in L.A. nearly 20 years now. So, I will start this off by saying I have seen Collateral theatrically a couple times, including at Beyond Fest. I believe it was last year, maybe the year before. All time is kind of folding in on itself these days. But I saw it with Michael Mann in attendance. And before we even talk about the movie, I just want to share this anecdote just because I think it's fucking adorable. I went to go see the film with our mutual buddy Jordan Harper, and we're watching the movie, and Jordan starts giving me like the elbow and kind of like, you know, nodding to the left, and I look over, and surreptitiously winding his way through the aisles midway through the film is Michael fucking Mann, because he's going to do a Q&A between this film and the second film, which was Thief. And it's right about the time.
What a double feature.
Yeah. It's right about the time of the nightclub shootout. And so Mann ends up sitting like next to us, like just like one seat down, right?
What? Same row?
Yeah, like literally, like he was with someone, I assume is his wife. There were some seats, you know, they'll mark the seats off at Beyond Fest for speakers and stuff, and we just happened to be in that aisle. And you know, Jordan's like, you know, nudging me, and I look over, and it's Michael Mann sitting there. And what was great about it is you think I, or at least I do, you assume Michael Mann is this kind of cold, implacable, you know, just force of icy intellectualism and artistry. And during the shootout, which is hypnotizing, I managed to peel my eyes away and keep looking over at him, because the longer that shootout went on, and not just the shootout, but the action and the waves of security forces working against Vincent in that sequence, Mann starts rocking side to side like fucking John Doe in the police car at the end of Seven. And he starts like giggling, and you can see, and he starts nudging the way Jordan was nudging me. He starts nudging, I guess it was his wife, starts nudging her and like elbowing her and like giggling. And it was just so fun and sweet to see that he was just getting such a fucking kick out of his movie. And the way you know, that sequence, that thing plays like a song. It's great. And watching him watch that and see that, and you could feel the electricity of the crowd, who I don't think most of them knew he'd walked in,
yeah.
Because we were sitting kind of in the middle towards the back, and so he was just watching them react, and the crowd was there was really a thrum in the crowd during that sequence, because you know, the movie, it's not like it's boring by any means, but the movie really snaps itself awake during that sequence. It kind of is building to that, you know, and then it climaxes with the wreck right after. And just watching him watch his own work and getting such a kick at it, giggling like a little kid, and like I said, just rocking side to side, like he couldn't sit still. That is a treasured memory, a movie memory for me, a treasured Michael Mann movie memory. And I just like that, you know, it was a different side of him, I think, than what we get from the public persona. He was literally like giggling like a little boy. And I love that.
That is such a beautiful story. And I want to tell everyone, if you haven't gone back to listen to Michael Mann on our shows, you should. And I think a lot of people have gone back and listened to the finale of One Heat Minute. Thank you so much for doing that. But it's actually sometimes funny a conversation to listen to him pop in for the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans, because that was one of the first times where I saw the glee and I guess the playfulness more so in that, because I remember when I was asking him about, like you said, this is like, it plays like a song, and it's like the Paul Oakenfold, like amazing tune, just like, it's so hypnotic and so catchy. And I remember when he was describing Last of the Mohicans, I was like, you know, you're setting it to this song. It's so percussive, it's put together like a watch. And he was just like, he actually said, I was so obsessed, it had to be fucking perfect. And he was just like, and that was his aspiration, you know, like, so it's so funny to hear him even like all these decades later still having such a passion for that perfection. So it doesn't surprise me that he was getting a kick out of it, because I don't imagine he's just like putting it on, chucking on Collateral in the Ford Pass Theater Ed or whatever, or checking it out, you know, he's not doing it all the time. But like, to still see that it's making an impact, and clearly I haven't seen Collateral in a theater. I don't think there's been many rep screenings in Australia, but man, I would love to see it in a theater projected on a beautiful 4K. I think it would look amazing.
Collateral in the theater plays. Is a ripper. I saw it. I cannot imagine what the Beyond Fest audience was like. I was not there, probably because my sister was getting married. But if it was
how
last
dare
year,
she? How dare I know. She?
Next year, she needs to. Next time she gets married, she needs to consult with me. Just kidding. She won't get married another time. But I saw it at the New Bev on like a Friday afternoon with like that crowd, and it played like a comedy, and it was so fun. But you know, of course, it plays like a comedy because you have Tom Cruise like doing his villainous self. But you know, but then you have the great nightclub shootout sequence, and everyone's just losing their shit over that. So yeah, it's so fun with an audience. It's one of the top 10 experiences.
Now, Katie,
this is your favorite.
It is Katie's favorite man. But Travis, Katie, you know what this screening was, right? This was the night where we got bombarded on Twitter because someone allegedly asked a Miami Vice question. And I've forgotten to ask Travis, who was in the audience.
No, Mark Olson told us it wasn't true.
No,
he
Mark
moderated
Olson said it,
the Q&A.
Yeah, he said it wasn't true. But so there was no Miami Vice question with Michael Mann's puzzlement. Okay, this is, we're dispelling myths here, guys. That
there were,
online.
I mean, I would these, have like, texted Twitter you guys breaks. From, I would have sent you messages like from there.
Yeah, of course.
Had that happened.
What are we
I
thinking?
Mean, I would have,
what are we thinking?
I think, you know, Jordan and I both would have sent you guys SOS, like give us something to ask about Miami Vice if he's talking about it. No. But I was just curious before we dive into chewing the rag on this movie proper, what makes this, Katie, what makes this your favorite man?
Oh, good question. I think I love that it's an LA movie, and I always talk about how like I love that he gets the geography of LA right, and it's like very intrinsic obviously to the story of the movie. But I think I just like that it starts and doesn't stop. It's short, it's just like relentless. The momentum never, you know, doesn't take its foot off the gas. I love Tom Cruise. I love Jamie Foxx. I don't know. It's just like a perfect little bite. It's not even a little bite. It's a big bite. But it's just everything about it is I think there's not an inch of fat on the thing, and I don't know. I just like you start watching it and you realize that like all other movies don't have the same sense of ease that this one does. There's something about it where you're just like, he makes it look easy.
Makes this really intricate thing look easy. I think the thing also that has brought it up in my estimations, you know, it's so hard to even know what my rankings are beyond Heat is number one. And then, you know, next could be any of four movies. But like even the things that we've learned, like talking on this, so like Justin Lieberman, who was an assistant on the set, told us a story of like Tom Cruise doing his sixth or seventh take, a walk up to an apartment building, and Michael's looking behind the camera, looking at the viewfinder, having a chat to his, you know, DOP, and they're getting Tom to do it again, and Tom quickly walks over and he's like, oh, is everything okay, like what am I doing something wrong, and Michael shows him like a playback and goes, no, there was this great sort of half a shot where a plane was, you know, plane light was flickering in the background of you walking. And I'm just trying to see if we can get one that's going down the similar flight path. And Tom Cruise is like, oh, I'll get my plane to fly. And then rings in the night, in the middle of the night, like some airport somewhere like in the south of LA or whatever, and gets a pilot up in the air in his plane with the lights on to fly through their shot. And I'm like,
Jesus goddamn Christ.
I'm like, these guys, I go, aren't they a match made in heaven? These two psychos aren't the, and I say that with such love and reverence, like they're my favorites. Just,
I think it is that combo of man and Cruise being completely obsessive perfectionists and Cruise playing a villain. And I don't know. I love it so much. I don't know why.
Well, that's probably why Cruise works so well here, is because Cruise from all that we know about him, is kind of a Michael Mann character in his obsessive, almost pathological dedication to perfection, even if that perfection is like intentionally a flawed perfection. He's kind of, it just occurred to me just as we're talking about this, he is kind of a walking, talking, he's a man.
He totally is.
He's a real man. And I don't think I've heard that episode. So that's insane to me. I mean, it's insane, but also totally expected. That's the other thing.
So you tell people that story, and their first reaction is like, "That's insane." And they're like, "Oh, that no, that."
Then they're like, I mean, the motherfucker's driving motorcycles off mountains here to save
the
cinema.
He can do is just fly a plane from Van Nuys to downtown and on a very specific timed.
Which, by the way, a specific vector. I need a vector.
A vector. Yep. Oh, look at Blake. Which again is another argument for the smeary digital photography of this film, which I know some people nitpick, but that's the only way to shoot at night and not set up for 19 hours.
Who is nitpicking?
Well, people have.
I need a list of names.
Katie's actually, like Jay and Silent Bob in Jay and Silent Bob's Strike Back, just with a phone book going to people's houses door to door and beating them up.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna beat anyone up. I'm just gonna ask.
You
to
know
talk
some
to them.
People they get pissy. They get pissy about Digital Man. And as much a proponent of film as we might be, the digital photography. Even 2004 digital photography looks rather lovely in this film, and the definitions that it finds in the darkness. It's such a great, as Katie, as you said, I mean, I'm not blowing anyone's hair white by declaring this, but it's such a great Los Angeles movie. And as much as I think so much of cinema, the cinema of LA is focused on sunshine, LA, it has such a character at night. It has such a vibe, to use that horrible word. It has such a vibe at night. And the way that the digital cameras capture, Katie, I think, will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's a very specific feeling of Los Angeles at night where it gets a little humid, the air's a little wet, the orange sodium vapor streetlights are reflected against the bottom of this canopy of clouds. So the sky takes on this bizarre kind of burnt orange pallor. And there's always these two tall palm trees curving up against that like burnt orange cataract, like the rib cage of some dead giant. And LA just has that very still, odd, surreal feeling at night that celluloid can't quite capture without, you know, you need too many lights for film. It would blow all of that away. And just a quick shout out to the digital photography of this film, which I think is staggeringly beautiful. And I don't know that I've seen another film that captures Los Angeles at night in quite the same way. It's so fucking beautiful. Take everything else away. It's just such a beautiful portrait of LA at night.
Yeah, and I think the form follows the function, the storytelling, the subtext, because, or serves it, doesn't follow it, because it's the thing about the digital photography is that it captures so much more of LA at night, which another thing we talked to both Elliot kind of and Justin about too, is that like Elliot was talking about how if you're using Elliot Koretz, the supervising sound editor, if you're using digital cameras, you're capturing so many more images or depth of field because it's not the blackest blacks of celluloid. And so then you suddenly have to layer in all these other sounds of things that you can see. And I think it captures like the expansiveness of LA at night and the stuff that's out there. It doesn't feel claustrophobic. This film to me, it feels open and expansive, and there are things like coyotes that can come running out onto the street, or whatever it is, predators of any kind that can come out.
That has happened to me. I sent you guys that video. It was like,
it looked like a shot from
2:50 in the morning. I was at a red light 2:50 a.m. Silver Lake, and it was January, still cold outside. And while I'm waiting for the light to go green, there's just coyote crosses the street, stops, looks at me, and then just keeps on its way, literally like out of the movie. I mean, you would have expected Audio Slave to start blaring from my speakers uncontrollably when it happened.
Please tell me you just started singing. I know we've got the footage, and I was hoping so much that I started to hear you go, "Once upon a time." I just wanted something, Travis.
Michael Mann's taste in music. Oh boy, that's a whole other podcast.
I know.
His 21st century taste in music is well, anyway.
Katie, what was your playlist that you shared with me recently on Spotify? It was like, you told me the name of one of your playlists. It was like trashy. What was the title of it? I'm gonna go find it.
Oh yes. I made this playlist with a friend of mine. It was like something bangers. It was like horrible bangers or something.
Yes.
I don't know that I would call it Cringe Bops.
Cringe Bop. Cringe Bop. That's it, yeah.
I don't know that I mean maybe Audio Slave could be a cringe bop. I do have I have 311 and Limp Bizkit Crazy Town and
Cringe Bops, Travis. That's exactly the purpose.
Oh my God. Something just started playing. Buck Cherry's on here.
Oh God.
Nickelback, obviously, and yeah. Various other ones. It was a playlist. I love this playlist. I made it with my best friends from growing up, and so we were just laughing and screaming about like horrible songs that we used to like or still do like.
Yes.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Audio Slave. I don't know. It's on the border of a cringe bop.
You know, Michael Mann. So powerful is his filmmaking that he could even make Moby cool twice. Two different films. He just hasn't yet accomplished that vis-a-vis Audio Slave for me.
I don't know. I think people like the Audio Slave.
It's actually three.
Three Mobys?
Three Mobys. In Ali, there is an amazing.
You're right. I'm wrong. Yeah, I made a fool of myself. You're right.
No, you're not a fool. I'm just a psycho. It's just I'm the person who's going and listening to Michael Mann soundtracks very frequently. But
also in Collateral, he has that Roots song.
Yes.
He made all his assistants like make him a playlist, and he was like, I'm trying to imagine him like being like, yeah, this one's good.
A listening party with Michael Mann to decide what's getting in the movie. Now that's a fun meeting. That's a great meeting.
Yeah.
Come to me with what is your bangers.
Yes. Bring me your cringe bops.
Bring me your cringe bops. what sounds like LA to you?
Yeah.
So good.
So before we, before we get into the movie, even though we're into the movie, but before we get into the stuff that I was going to mention about the movie, one more question. How come Vincent doesn't fly into Burbank if he's so smart? If he's so fucking smart, like, why isn't he just flying to Burbank?
Because he's like on an international flight or something.
Oh, you know what? There it is. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yes. You're right.
It's not a domestic flight. He's not bopping down from SF.
Okay, can sure. I please? Can I? Yeah, he's not from San. That yeah, he's not from SF at that time.
I mean,
he's,
I know that. I mean, man's secret backstory for Vincent is that he, to use man's parlance, he has a domicile in Thailand.
Domicile in Thailand.
Offshore Thailand. So you know what? That's right. That's why he wouldn't, because you got to international flights. Yeah.
Now, can we please now? This beautiful triangulation together, make a promise.
Mm.
When, and I think at the rate my hair is going gray, it's going to be perfect for like a next year visit. When I come into LAX,
I will be in a gray suit
and I would like one of you to bump into me while we carry briefcases. And the other one of us, I don't care who bumps into me, but then we just, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm okay. And then just walk away from each other in the crowd of LAX. And just do that and then have that footage for us. I think that's the only way that I'd like to be, you know, collected from LAX by you guys. Yeah.
Bring and then, my finest attaché case.
And then we're going to just drive the route of collateral.
Yeah. That's
and it. We're not taking you back to your hotel or your wherever you're staying until we do the entire
movie.
And you're like, I'm exhausted, I'm jet lagged, and we're like, no,
we
haven't gotten you to won't club.
Hear, you won't hear that from me. I'll be like, I can't wait to get to Oakenfeld. Let's do this.
Wait, what's that club called again? Like
Club Fever.
Club Fever. Yeah. I was gonna say Club Fire. I want to go to Club Fever.
I really want to go to Club Fever. I really do. I want to keep this party going. There's a party happening last night. I'm like, I'm ready.
Oh, boy.
I'm ready.
Rally.
Rally.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
So to dive into a couple of things I wanted to talk about with this movie, I'll give you guys a choice. Do you want to start with the long and storied history of Chicano murals in Los Angeles, or Socrates killing himself with hemlock after his trial? Which one do we want to do? Okay, murals it is. Murals it is. we're gonna roll with it. I Ching, little jazz. The film begins after the LAX moment. The film begins with Max the cabbie leaving his the cab garage, and there is a very kind of blinker, you'll miss it, but as he's pulling out, there is a mural. This massive mural on a wall of a headless horseman fighting a bull. The horseman is headless because the artist who painted that mural in 1974 quit before they were done and left it unfinished. So you have this vaquero, this cowboy, this headless cowboy being chased by this angry looking black bull. And this mural is for people who aren't in LA, LA is kind of known as the mural capital of the world because of our longstanding history of mural artwork. Since the original settlement of the Pobladores in Los Angeles hundreds of years ago, Chicano art has been a foundational part of the culture of this area. And part of that, especially in the 20th century, was mural art spreading across the city. And one of such murals is the one I'm talking about now, which is located in Estrada Courts, which is this federal housing project with a bunch of murals. And I swear to God, Blake knows this. Katie, I'm going to remind you, I am going to get somewhere with this. Now, the thing is, Estrada Courts, which is, like I said, it's a federal housing project in Boyle Heights. And that is where, man, because he's an LA guy, he saw this mural. And he insisted that the production team replicate that mural in front of this cab stand set. And I was curious, you wonder why, or at least because I'm insane and creepy, according to Blake. I wondered with why. Love. And I realize that kind of really is the film in microcosm, at least to me, an unfinished writer or a driver being chased by this monstrous bull, this monster. And in the film, we have the same thing. We have an unfinished man who is being chased by a monster. And in being chased by that monster is actually kind of catalyzed and actualized into being a complete person. And it's one of those little things where, if you don't think about, if you're not insane and you don't think about stuff like that, the movie works just fine. But then when you're insane, and you see something like that, it adds just this level of beauty to the movie, and sadness to the movie, at least for me, because this is really, as much as it is just Stuart Beatty's, you know, really crackerjack premise, you know, what if an assassin gets in your cab, you're kind of stuck with the guy. To me, this movie is, it's really kind of a, almost a tragedy or of a character study of someone like Max, who lives a very unfinished life, just as this muralist left his painting undone. And, you know, I was watching the film again yesterday, and I was thinking to myself how it really is like a chamber music piece covering, meditating on the orchestral themes of Heat. It's Heat kind of in miniature in a way. And I think part of that was because, since this is the only project, I believe, of Mann's that he did not write, that he was looking for a project that condensed, that took place over a condensed period of time in Los Angeles. You know, I wonder if when Mann found this script, he's like, my only way in, I've got to hang something on this film that I can understand. And what he did is, at least in my eyes, is, it's odd to me that everyone got so excited about Heat 2, because Collateral has always kind of felt like Heat 2 to me, in that it is kind of an application of Mann's obsessions, which reach full flower in Heat. It's kind of an application of those to this film, because in Heat, you have these two men who are kind of unfinished in some way. They are missing something. You know, for Neil, you could say it's Fiji, you could say it's Edie, and for Vincent, it's just the next person that is his prey. And together, these two forces, they come together, and inadvertently allow for only one of the two of them to achieve what Mann calls the heightened experience of their life. And it's interesting that this film, which also features a main character named Vincent, is about these two men who are both missing something. One literally, in that Vincent is a sociopath and he is missing standard parts that a normal human being would have. And the other is figuratively missing something, which is Max, who is missing that barrier. He's missing that thing that would allow him to actualize himself and pursue his dreams. And they inadvertently goad each other towards the other side of the fence, in a way, though, that only allows one of them to achieve any kind of actualization or goal. And I know I'm rambling now, as I tend to do, but that all comes back to that mural to me of a bull chasing a incomplete figure to achieve, and in a weird way, and it's going somewhere. In a weird way, to me, Collateral, the film, is the finishing brushstrokes that were begun in 1974 by that muralist, in a way that Mann finishes that muralist's portrait with Collateral, in which the headless rider, the headless cowboy, becomes finished, becomes actualized, becomes complete through the events of the film. Which, yes, I know it's nuts, but like that was my takeaway watching the movie yesterday.
I think it's a great take, because it's not as nuts as you might think just right from like that outset. It's because the amazing Alex Colville painting of the man standing against the glass window with a gun in the background on his sort of like sketch table is this sort of anonymized person who's like his workbench is a gun. That was a core inspiration, like that was the mood board, if you like, for Neil McCauley and Heat. And so when you see that mural, it's just like, you know, I think you put it really, really phenomenally, which is that like Stuart Beatty's crackerjack, as you put it, script is really hard to penetrate and break down and dismantle, because it's structured so beautifully. But, you know, the change of setting, the change of some of those themes, the adding in of the Los Angeles culture is all of the Michael Mann stuff. Like, that's why I think us Mannheads love it so much, is because it's these tactical doses of all of these thematic preoccupations that we love that are just applied and fused to this like really speedy thing. And so, yeah, I don't think it's a fantastic take. And also he does that, like, you know, we were talking about it with like it's happened in you know, movies like Black Hat. It's happened in Miami Vice, where he like sees murals and on the streets of different places around the world, you know, Ciudad del Este or Haiti or whatever. He sees a mural on a wall and he's like, I want that mural, or I want that artist to do that mural again. I'll do a copy of their mural in a subterranean basement where Jose Euro is going to, you know, throw a grenade or, you know, get a grenade held in front of his face, etc. And be threatened to become his own Jackson Pollock. You know, like he loves taking those things because there is something like, you know, everything's intentional. And that's why he's such a fun filmmaker to constantly talk about and revisit, because that one detail for you is it helps you unlock the theme of the movie. And it definitely happens across all of his work. Like he finds that inspiration. And sometimes when he wants to see those images, like he'll actually manufacture it. So it's kind of like the subtext of the movie is he wants you to see it in that moment, like especially right at the very start of the movie. I think that's really cool.
I just want to touch on one thing you said, Travis, that kind of confused me for a second, but then brought up some interesting ideas. But you said you were talking about Heat and Macaulay, and then you said, and Vincent is looking for his next prey. And I thought you were talking about Vincent Collateral, but you were talking about Vincent Hanna.
Vincent Hanna, yeah.
And his prey is Macaulay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would not describe him that as a predator, but he is in that sense. So that was an interesting point for me. And then you started talking about Vincent Collateral and Max, and that he, you know, that Vincent is also a predator looking for prey, and he's even more like kind of lizard brain oriented, yeah, in some ways. Like I believe in the third act of the movie that he like goes, he turns into a shark or a coyote or a Terminator, and just goes full animal, feral.
Wearing his human mask for two, yes, acts of the movie, and then once he hits Club Fever, all of that is shed. It's like, see ya. It's gone.
Right. Once he sees the coyote and he's like, recognizes himself. But I don't know. It was just really interesting to hear you describe Vincent Hanna as a predator, because I would not have categorized him that way. And my take on Collateral is like, what happens when you put a psychopath and an empath, who are both deeply professional men, who need to get a job done, into this closed space? And like, how does that work out? Because there are so many times in Collateral where you're like, Max, just leave.
Yeah. Drive away.
He, like, there are reasons why he doesn't, right? Like, oh, his mom or the body or whatever. But like, there are many moments where you're just like, run away. Yeah. And he just like has to get the job done. He's like, I'm gonna get this job done. But he also is like such an empath in such a way that he like connects to this woman who he now feels he needs to protect. And I know this is like kind of a hot take, but I think that, I don't know, like is Vincent Hanna also the empath and Macaulay the psychopath? Like, what's the dynamic there?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely think Hanna is to how much, however much I can stretch that term, an empath. You know, you watch throughout the film, and also the man's excellent film school level commentary track for Heat. You know, he constantly is mentioning that sometimes to his own emotional dissolution, Hanna will force himself to listen, to take in sensory input that pains him, because it might be of use somewhere down the line, whether it's literally holding the mother of a dead teenage sex worker,
that's what I'm
and communicating with her, because there might be something he can use later, whether it's, you know, the central scene, the central sequence of Heat, when Hanna and Macaulay are sitting at Kate Mantellini's, which was instigated by Hanna. Hannah's doing it because he is out of options. He is out of ideas. And the thinking of his character in that moment is, maybe if I just sit down and talk to this motherfucker, I will glean something. I will empathically sense something. I will recognize something of his humanity that I can use to, as a predator, catch him later. And what does Hanna learn? What does Hanna get?
I have a woman.
I have a woman. That's what he gets out of Macaulay in the Tuckers. I've got a woman. Well, I tell her I'm a salesman. And how does that come into play? At the airport, at the end of the film, he sees one confused woman sitting in a car looking around and waiting for someone.
Amongst the chaotic panic of an evacuation, there is a woman sitting in a car looking for a man.
And so I think that, I think Macaulay is a sociopath or psychopath, whichever, in that, when it rains, you get wet, which is just, that's some Ted Bundy shit. he might love Edie, but that is some Ted Bundy shit. Whereas Vincent's goal is the preservation of life at all costs. Right. And you could argue to a degree that that is also what Max is doing in this film, is especially in that third act when, Vincent basically becomes Jason Voorhees. Max could walk. After the wreck, Max could walk.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or hobble as it is. But instead he decides to return and to fight to preserve life at all costs. And so again, it is very much kind of a Heat in miniature to me. It's also another film that is a panorama of Los Angeles. I mean, what is the tagline of Heat? A Los Angeles crime saga. And so I think, and I don't mean that to Collateral's detriment. I think it's more man taking a work that was not organically his own and attaching it with his own obsessions as a way to find his way in. And just as much as Macaulay inadvertently goads every move that Macaulay makes presses Hannah further and further, or presses or pulls Hannah closer and closer to murdering him. Just as like in Collateral, you watch that movie the first time and those scenes in the cab. Hey, Lady Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, you no longer have the cleanest cab in La La Land. These scenes where Tom Cruise is espousing his philosophy. The first time you watch that, you could just be like, oh, well, this is just a cool crime guy doing cool crime shit, saying cool, nihilistic shit. Like a villainous Rust Cole or some shit like that, where it's like, oh, this is just a character. This is just screenwriting 101, where a character is.
I don't sleep, I dream.
Yeah, this is a character just showing us who they are vis-a-vis their philosophy. But instead, no, when you watch scenes like that, Vincent's speeches are designed for a purpose. What man calls facile nihilism. Especially like say in that scene after he kills the CI, the fat man that falls out of his window, Max is in shock. Max is slipping into an almost fugue-like state as he's trying to drive. He's just in full-on shock, picking up sandwiches off of his seat. And Vincent, in an expert move of psychological manipulation, starts challenging Max and challenging Max's beliefs by bombarding him with the weapons grade level nihilism. He's not doing that for the reason you might think he is when you first watch it, which is just like I said, that screenwriting 101, characters are what they say. No, he's doing that because he's keeping Max sharp on the edge where he's got to be. Yeah. And he is pulling Max out of that fugue state. But what is interesting about that is that Vincent is too effective, and by constantly challenging Max with this philosophical assault, he is actually actualizing Max. He is angering Max, this headless vaquero. He is angering the headless cowboy into as a counter move to formulating his own anti-Vincent philosophy. And that's where, again, the meat of the film to me mirrors so much of Heat, where one character makes a move that actualizes the other character against him. For every move that Vincent makes to draw an outline around Max as a psychotic spree killer, taxi driver, because, he's going to end the movie by putting two in the chest, one in the head of Max's body, and leaving him to be the suspect in all these killings. But what he's actually doing is he thinks he's drawing that outline around Max, but what he's forcing Max to do is to draw his own outline. He is forcing the muralist to finish the head of this cowboy, and he is forcing Max to come up with his own moral code and moral compass and his own image, philosophical image. And I know we're getting like heady here, but that's so much of the movie to me is that, is Max actualizing in the face of Vincent's philosophical taunting.
I mean, we're talking about these polarities, like the psychopath, the empath, the predator, the prey, but it's all, I think it's so interesting what you're saying about like, about the self-actualizing, but to also think about who is proactive and who is reactive, especially in these dynamics. And I think it's easy to look at Max as a very reactive character, and he is for a lot of the movie. And then, but if he's also aligned with, if we are making this thought experiment, you know, if he's also aligned with Vincent Hanna, you know, Vincent Hanna is very proactive. Like, he's going out and getting Macaulay and drawing him in, but they're like in this weird dance together. And I think that's why we like love these movies so much and rewatch them constantly, because we can't get enough of this dance of these two polar opposites who are closer and more alike than they think, or we might assume.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, this metaphor that I'm using, it only goes so far. I mean, I'm obviously, you know,
but can I layer one last thing before we say
he's not a hard-ass cop?
Can I layer that one thing? But it's to your point. It's like, what is actualization? But like actually knowing that your hands are on the wheel, sort of thing. So there's that great moment where he's like, he actually realizes, oh shit, I'm in a cab.
I'm
like,
the one driving the car.
I'm driving the car.
I'm riding the horse. I'm the cowboy riding the horse. Like,
yeah,
the bull is chasing me.
And he's like, oh no, how about if I just flip this fucking thing? I'm gonna literally flip. It's like, I am in control. He keeps telling
me, Vincent,
that
go fuck yourself.
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. Such a great thing.
But that's the thing, is he would never have been capable of doing that. Yeah. If Vincent hadn't existed,
he just,
and that's the thing,
prodded it out of him. He like
Anna would not have reached the heightened experience of his life, to steal another man phrase. He would not have been able to achieve that without Neil McCauley being a psychopath.
And neither would have Max.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the point. Max would not have achieved. Max would not become the cowboy with a head. Were there not a monstrous bull chasing him to complete the mural? And interestingly, Max does the same to Vincent in a negative way. You know, Vincent is very clearly, through the philosophy that he reveals, to taunt Max, but also it does reveal who he is. And that's why it's a nifty bit of screenwriting, is it's accomplishing so many things at once. Vincent is revealed, you know, he's clearly a social Darwinist. And the thing that Max does to Vincent is, as he very clearly states, you know, near the end of the film, he's like, you're low down. I think you're low, brother. I think that there are the standard parts that are in other human beings are missing in you. And someone held a gun to your head and made you say, what is going on in the head of this person over here? You wouldn't be able to do it, because like other people aren't real to him.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that is, when Max makes clear to a social Darwinist that there are things in him that are missing, Vincent begins to recognize that there is something wrong with, faulty in himself, that as to quote, again, I'm going to keep quoting, man, he's damaged goods in a tailored suit.
Yeah.
And I think that those fractures begin to dissolve Vincent and begin to unravel Vincent. And, you know, everybody can have, and should and does have, different opinions on what the coyote scene means.
Yeah.
To me, what that sequence is, you know, the light goes green and Max continues to wait. And I think what happens to me, for me in that scene, what is happening is Max waits for the coyote to cross, even though the light's green. Vincent is probably, I think, is sitting there wondering, why isn't Max going? Why isn't Max just hitting the gas? We have a thing to do. And I think in that moment, where in the past, Vincent would just make a joke or, you know, say, let's punch it. You know, Lady Macbeth, you no longer have the cleanest cab in La La Land. He's recognizing, oh, he's stopping because he doesn't want to risk killing this animal. And I think in that moment, you see this look of almost revelation on Vincent's face. Like he's realizing, I would never have done that.
Yes.
And the consideration of that and the consideration that perhaps there is something missing in him, it unravels him. And you could even, you know, you could reach back to Heat and be like, you know, McCully is very clearly unraveling by the end of Heat, making decisions he would previously never have made or would have made, but he has built an entire lifestyle to prevent something like that from happening. He has invented a persona to keep himself under control, much as Vincent does and much as Vincent loses after this fact. And I find that interesting. These two men have such a, if we want to quote True Detective again, boy, you two sure fucked each other up, didn't you? And I just find these films kind of twin films in a way, having a conversation with each other the way their main characters have conversations with each other. And for as much as Vincent inadvertently actualizes Max, Max kind of inadvertently dissolves Vincent. And neither man seems to recognize that until it's far, far too late for either of them to do anything about it other than continue on the course that has been laid out for them by each other. And that's some really fascinating shit for what on its surface is just kind of a thrilling drama or dramatic thriller in Los Angeles. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I watched this movie with my mom and it was hilarious, like watching her react to it. But like, yes, I'm loving these like deep philosophical conversations about archetypes too, because I think it contains that as well. And I also think it's interesting, the coyote scene is right after Fanning is killed.
Mm.
And I think that's when, I mean, we got to talk Fanning, but that's Fanning. When
I had some thoughts about Fanning.
Max realizes that he has to self-actualize in order to save himself.
Yes.
Oh yeah. I mean, at that point he knows he's fucked otherwise.
Like no one is coming to save him. So that's the point when and maybe him resting, hesitating at the green light is like him starting to make his own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Realizing that he can.
And the only point of contention I'd have your whole theory there, Trav, is like, I don't think Max, in the end of this movie that Vincent wants to happen, Max is not getting two in the chest and one in the head. Max is getting one in the head.
He's making a little suicide. Yeah, you're right.
He's the guy who's gonna be nailed as a suicide and a crazy cab driver that does all this stuff. But right. Yeah, you're so right. It's like in that moment, it's that. All right, let's dive into Fanning really quickly in wrapping up, because just like it happens, there's a beautiful symmetry. A year ago-ish, you go and see Katie's lovely sister gets married. You and Jordan go and see this movie in a double feature, and you guys are on the precipice of going to see a man movie together at Beyond Fest, which is very exciting. So before we dive into that and maybe preview some excitement with that, let's talk Fanning. Katie's like Dirtbag Hall of Fame Fanning.
I don't like him. I don't like him. I'm sorry. I don't like
what?
Him. You know, I don't want to insult anybody. Listen, he's well performed by Ruffalo. You know, I gotta say, like once or twice a month, I will mutter to myself, because maybe Blake's right, maybe I am creepy. I will mutter to myself, I don't know why. I will mutter to myself, Roof's all beat to shit. Roof's all beat to shit. I don't know why that sticks with me, but it does. The way he does that, like there's something cool about that. And I always think about that. Whenever someone is showing me something on their phone or TV, like I hear Roof's all beat to, like I want to say that about whatever footage they're playing. Yeah, I gotta be honest, you know, if there's a flaw to the film for me, and the reason it's maybe not my favorite Mecha Man is Thief, followed very closely by Heat, followed very closely by Miami Vice, and everything else kind of just arranges itself in a top whatever based on my mood of the day. I think the only thing that kind of keeps Collateral out of that top three for me is
Do Mommy and Daddy know you? You're right.
Yeah,
Mommy and Daddy. That's what's holding Collateral back.
Well, what's holding Collateral back for me is Fanning is kind of just, he is a narrative construction that is basically designed to pop in every once in a while to explain to us why Vincent is killing all of these people. and connecting the dots for us that, oh, okay, there's a case. Okay, there's a, the DA is getting ready to go to the grand jury tomorrow. Some indictments are coming down, and he kind of exists just to verbalize those things for us. He pops up, does that, and then pops back out. And then,
but can I just touch on one thing? I love in the spirit of the way that you've like structured your take, which I think is really fantastic about the, you know, one of the huge thematic preoccupations of this movie. I think Fanning, and it, like much like Ruffalo, and much like really great movies where when you're with a new character, it feels like they feel like they're in their own movie. I feel like Fanning thinks that he's the hero of this movie.
Oh, he definitely is in his own movie. There is definitely a movie like happening with just Fanning.
That's what I'm saying. That's why I really love him. So, like, I do know he's a narrative construction. Obviously, you know, we is part of the way that we like go through this process. It's impossible not to try and penetrate like the screenwriting trickery and stuff like that. And what's so enriching for Katie and I in an ongoing basis is when we learn about things like from Elliot Caretz and Justin Lieberman about like the depth of field and how that changes the sound design of the movie and like these implicit things that you don't realize are big ticket items. Like you sort of, the more like face value things of like who's doing the exposition and driving the overall conspiracy that's driving this thriller, it is Fanning. But I love that in this movie, every single time I watch him, I'm like, Fanning thinks he's the star of this movie.
Oh yeah,
like, I love that so much, because every I'm like, bro, you're about to die. Like, now it's impossible to detach from my knowing his fate when I watch it. So it's just so interesting to me every time I watch him. He's so hypnotic in that regard, because I'm like, oh, he this poor guy, he thinks it's his movie. It's not his movie. It's Max's movie.
And you know, it's Max Vincent. And I get that he's, you know, he's dirtbag hot. I get it. Like, I'm not denying that. But he definitely is, you know, he's Janet Leigh in Psycho. He's Angie Dickinson in Dressed to Kill. He shows up, he drops some exposition. And when the movie, the one thing that does kind of make me chuckle is when the movie is done with his ass and doesn't need any more exposition, he takes two to the chest, one to the head, and they get him the fuck out of there. Like, he's literally executed when his plot convenience role is done and exhausted. The movie literally fucking executes his ass and moves on.
I just want to say, aren't they all fucking narrative construction?
Sure, they are.
Yes. Isn't everything a narrative device?
Like... And unfortunately, we just don't get enough. I mean, Mann does his best. Ruffalo does his best. You can, you know, to provide character via performance and the things that he does, things that he says. There's nothing wrong with it. I think that he's really great in the role, Ruffalo. I think the character is kind of interesting. I love that anyone working undercover narco vice in a Michael Mann movie has to have that fucking mustache. It's just one of those things that, like, it just never quite coheres for me. You can kind of feel the seams a little bit of why he's there. And, you know, I was never quite shocked when he got killed because of that. I was a bit more like Rachel McAdams in Game Night when the beefcake bodyguard looks just like Blake gets sucked into a jet engine and she's just like, oh, he died. That's kind of how I felt when Ruffalo got killed. I'm like, oh, he died. Well, back to the movie, back to the adventure at hand.
Meanwhile, my mom is literally screaming at the top of her lungs. No!
So you're saying that all the Walsh women have a thing for the dirt bag? That hit her hard, that one.
Yeah.
Speaking of this, two in the chest, one to the head. I got one more thing I got to say, okay. I promise. Vincent and what's interesting about Vincent and Max is that they both have these personas as prisons or prisons as personas. And I think what is interesting, much like Vincent and Neil's persona that becomes like a prison to him to survive is actually what gets him killed. And Vincent Hanna's ability to kind of play jazz, be an empath, read the room and play jazz with the materials that are given to him is what allows him to survive. You know, he sees the moving shadow in the field of LAX and he knows this is where Neil's going to come at me from. He knows just to blindly lift the gun and fire. Interestingly, this film ends exactly the same way, where Vincent, for all of his espousing of, hey man, you'd play jazz, you don't know where you're going to be 10 minutes from now. He does have a persona as prison, and that is he, whenever a situation feels out of control to him, he will enact a very rigid set of rules to bring things, the world, back into his favor. We see that happen in the middle of the fever shootout, and we see it when he, Yohomi, when he kills the gang members. It's two in the chest, one in the head. That is how he kills people. And the only reason that Max is able to kill this master assassin, who's been doing this for, you know, working for, you know, offshore narco traffickers for quite a while, ex-military, killing for the cartels, is that when you look at the bullet spray and indentions in the door between them on the Metro Green Line, where they have their face-to-face, there are, in the door that is between them, there are two bullets in the lodged in the center of the door and one at the top. He tried to do two to the chest, one to the head, to kill Max. Because deep down, his persona is to kill only in that way. Whereas if you watch Max moves his hand in a circular motion. He makes a circle with the gun as he fires.
Sprang,
he fires blindly. What does he do for the first time in his life? The guy at the club who said he doesn't like jazz, he plays jazz in that moment. He becomes actualized, and he learns from Vincent. He becomes actualized, and he shoots blindly and wildly, and just tries. He just tries for the first time in his life. He tries, and that is what kills Vincent. And Vincent is kind of infected by the old version of Max, which is to do things rigidly and not change. And that is what gets Vincent killed. And I find that utterly fucking fascinating. It is my favorite part of the movie, is that idea of persona as prison. And Max breaks out of his only because Vincent, the mad bull, helped him. Whereas Vincent becomes ensnared in his because Max infects him with that lack of actualization, that entropy that was swallowing his life, transfers itself in a way to Vincent. And the very fact that the film ends on the Green Line MTA stop, which is where Heat begins.
Where Heat begins.
It was literally where Heat begins. It's like this Ouroboros. I know I'm just rattling on, but I find that so fucking interesting. And the last thing I'm going to say, and then you guys can kick me the fuck off of here, is... as we all do, you know, in between thinking about the Roman Empire, sometimes I will think about the death of Socrates, which is an oil painting by the French painter Jacques-Louis David. And if you've seen this, or if you're aware of the story here, you know, Socrates was put on trial for infecting the minds of the youths of his age by not worshiping the gods of the state. And he was forced, not forced, they actually gave him lots of chances not to. He said, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway, to swallow hemlock and kill himself. And Jacques-Louis David painted this portrait of that, this neoclassical portrait. It's a gorgeous painting. And at the edge of the bed, while after he's poisoned himself, Socrates is, you know, waving his hand around. He's angry. And he's still expressing his philosophy to his followers. At the foot of the bed, Plato, gray hair, dressed in gray, is sitting with his head tilted downward like a dead, almost like a corpse. I always think of that painting when I watch the ending of this movie. I don't think it's intentional. I couldn't find anything. I mean, obviously, man is a autodidact. I'm sure he is aware of Jacques-Louis David, and I'm sure he's very aware of Plato, and he's very aware of Socrates. And it's not like Plato is the one dying in this painting, but he looks like he is. Whereas Socrates, his contemporary, is full of life and vigor. Plato looks dead, dressed again, all in gray hair, head tilted downward, slack, not moving. And what is interesting about both of these men, Socrates and Plato, is that you know, Socrates didn't even, you know, document or write down his philosophies. They were expressed as a series of conversations, back and forths, arguments, if you will, philosophical arguments between himself and another party. And Plato did much the same thing in what he called his Phaedos. Plato's Phaedos. Both philosophers basically expressed their philosophies as a series of dialogues and arguments between two parties. That's what Socratic irony is, the Socratic method is. And isn't that kind of what this whole fucking movie is? Is two dueling philosophies infecting each other, wrestling with each other, combating each other, transmuting each other? And so whether it's intentional or not, just to add a little extra bit of spice, a little flavor, a little extra something for pep in your step if you want it. The ending of this film so much reminds me of that painting where one of these philosophers is full of piss and vinegar, frankly, and is energized and alive. And the other is sullen and sallow and gray and dead looking and has lost the argument, if you will. And isn't that kind of what this movie is? It's two philosophers and only one of them gets to win the argument and be a completed vaquero on the horse. I don't know. This is just, my mind wanders. And so
I'm glad we let him ramble.
We begin it with two paintings today. That's what we're doing.
It's amazing. This was an amazing lecture. Mic drop. Boom.
It's a lecture.
No, it was great. I learned so much about everything, about life, about Los Angeles and paintings and murals and philosophy.
And you gave,
and much like Alan Jackson, a little bit, a lot about living, a little about love.
And you also gave me Katie's reaction face. What? When you said you didn't like Fanning, which is a
I'm
a
sorry.
Huge highlight.
I mean, I will admit he's cute. He's cute with his little slick back hair.
Thank
and his
you.
Mustache, and his jacket. And he looks cool when he's like, when he's just like, Roofs, I'll beat the shit. Roofs, I'll beat the shit.
Roofs, I'll beat the shit.
I don't know. I love that.
Well, you two are about to embark on LA Beyond Fest right now as we're recording this podcast. It will be up. This podcast will be published during Beyond Fest, I'm guessing. And you two will meet and also meet the man. As he's talking to Jimmy Hemphill, you're going to see Michael Mann talking about Manhunter together. Mm-hmm. What a night that is
tomorrow
going
night.
To be.
Do you think I should ask about Miami Vice?
I absolutely demand.
Do you think Jim
what
will
kind
take
of question is that?
Audience questions? Will Jim take audience questions?
He has in the past other Q&As. He has.
You know what,
and I know that
Travis,
Beyond Fest,
before
I feel like I need to do
Q&A.
The
before,
bit where I'm like,
this,
yo, I just want to say Miami Vice is a masterpiece.
Yeah, you have to do the bit, number one. Number two, grab Jim before the screening, Travis. You know Jim, he's a friend. And grab him and say, throw it to Katie. Got to throw it to Katie.
No, this is too much pressure.
Me and our good buddy Jordan is going as well. We will work on
I'm nervous.
I will slip you some more mango mojitos like I did at the Miami Vice screening.
Yes, there we go.
I'm scared.
Katie, you have to. For our people, you have to.
Do you know
how happy the reaction is anything like we're expecting.
I'm the type of person that like I love and respect artists, and I have a fine time just being like, cool, you're over there.
Yeah,
but I don't have to run up to you.
You can tell him that you love it from the safety of a seat. It's Q&A, so you know, it's fine.
I like how Katie says she doesn't have to run up to them when we all know full well she is going to be driving her shoulder into Colin Farrell's solar plexus when he's doing yoga in a park one day, and she's going to tackle his ass. And he will never be seen again.
This bit has gotten out of control.
I was actually going to do a whole thing about how it was going to be a gender reverse boxing Helena, but I'll save that for another
time. Oh, no, save that for another time. Another time and another show. Shout out to Green and Longworth. Great show. You must remember this. Travis, it's always a pleasure. This was excellent. I'm so glad that we did let you get to the death of Socrates. The death of Socrates. That was amazing. Amazing stuff. And I love that mural. I'm going to put those pictures up so that people can check it out. I'll make a link to it in the post. So if people are listening to this episode, go to oneheatminute.com. You'll see the link.
One last random thing about murals. If anyone is interested in that, Agnes Varda made a wonderful documentary in 1981 called Murmurs, which is entirely about the murals of Los Angeles. And just to keep things as wildly random in this episode as fucking possible.
Wow.
Let's end with an Agnes Varda 1981 documentary.
I didn't know we joined the dots on a Collateral Confessions between Agnes Varda and Michael Mann, but I'm here for it. I'm really.
I like to bring a lot of things to bear. You know that.
Renaissance man.
So, but yeah, I would recommend Murmurs if anyone is fascinated with the topic of LA murals, which is an incredibly rich and interesting one. And that's all I got to say about that. I'll shut up.
Enjoy Manhunter. This has been an absolute pleasure getting you in the cab. Can't wait. And I am going to be waiting by my phone for an account of what happens. And hopefully someone in that crowd standing up and saying, Miami Vice is a masterpiece, and you guys cataloging the response from the great one. I cannot wait. And I'm hoping very much that it's Katie Walsh, because I think we'll get about 7 episodes out of it. So that would be fantastic.
We'll get her there, Blake. Don't worry. We'll get her there.
It's going to become a button on the soundboard if that's the question.
The more you guys are saying, the more I'm literally not going.
Yeah, I know. No pressure.
Also, episode makes me realize, can you imagine the poor son of a bitch rideshare driver or cab driver that has to deal with me when I'm drunk and I'm talking about this shit in the back seat? Because I do. You know that painting when Socrates drank hemlock? And like, yeah, just made me realize the poor souls that ferried me around Los Angeles and the shit I've said while doing so.
And
amazing. Yeah. I'm sure they loved it.
The only thing I regret, not having a microphone. Not having your stream of consciousness to listen to. Put some sound effects under, drop in some clips.
Jesus Christ.
That's what we do. Guys, thank you so much for listening to another Collateral Confessions, part of the Miami Nice umbrella. You can find a stack of episodes for Travis on Increment Vice in this very feed if you want to do a search on whatever your podcast weapon of choice is, or just go to oneheatminute.com or incrementvice.com. You can find all of his stuff there. We're looking forward so much to Trav's growing tome on Brian De Palma. He's written some amazing pieces about De Palma at Brightwall Dark Room. You can probably find those, check them out, just search Travis Woods Brightwall Dark Room. You can see his whole catalog there. Really excited for some of that. Thank you so much for coming back, man, and talking to us again on Collateral. This has been a really fun one. Some good moments.
This is a corker.
A corker.
Nicholas.
A classic.
Aww.
Not creepy. Love. Look, I'll show you my eyes. My hungover eyes. Look at my loving hungover eyes to you, Travis. There's no.
Oh, thank you, honey bunny.
Nothing but love. Nothing but love.
Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.